We're trying something new. This is a Throwback Thursday episode of the show where we dig deep into the archives and pull something that we think will be relevant and useful to hear again, or for the first time, today. These are in addition to our regular programming because we think they'll add real value to the show. However, referring to them as Throwback Thursday was a little controversial. Amanda pointed out to me that Throwback Thursday was largely a social media phenomenon driven by Facebook in the mid-20-teens before they implemented Facebook memories. And it's true, Google Trends shows a big spike in searches around then, with Throwback Thursday peaking in April 2014. But then again, didn't we all? And besides, I say that if there's one thing to bring back after it's fallen out of style, it's throwbacks. Welcome to this Throwback Thursday edition of the award-winning Best of the Left podcast, where we remember the past and choose to repeat it. A version of this episode was originally published on January 22nd, 2019, and we've chosen it because just this week we published an episode on the power of marketing from corporations and how that influential force helped shape culture and our built infrastructure, often for the worse. So, looking back in the archives, this episode caught my eye because it encapsulates the greatest marketing topic of the 20th century, the Cold War propaganda that hardened the ideological divide between Soviet-style communism and American-style capitalism, making it nearly impossible for anyone to see through to the nuances on the other side. But with generational shift, that Cold War propaganda is thawing, and this episode explains why.
If we step back from the moment and, you know, with the advantage of hindsight, we can see that for much of the 20th century, the Soviet Union was the United States's ideological foil. Do you think that's something that we can find in 10 Days That Shook the World itself? Does Reed's work foreshadow that? Or what does it tell us about the kind of relationship that will emerge between the United States and the Soviet Union?
I think that he, like Lenin in some ways, in 1917, believed that there could be a good relationship between the two. He and Lenin talk about this. It's not reflected so much in his book, but they talk about how the United States and the Soviet Union at that time don't really have direct areas of conflict in the world, like trade and other sorts of things. And so there's no reason why they can't be friendly, even though they appear to be ideologically at odds. Mm-hmm. But you have to remember at the time that being a socialist or a communist in the United States, up until about this moment, was not seen as to be a negative thing necessarily. Eugene V. Debs, who was a quite famous candidate for president.
And we might add a socialist candidate for
a socialist candidate ran in 1912 and got 6 or 7% of the vote and got over 1 million votes. And so, I think the fear that's generated is one that is quite distinctly intentional by a small group of people among the elite, because what they saw happen in Russia was the nobles and landowners and people with status lost what they had. And I think that generates a fear, not only in the United States, but sort of worldwide, that if you allow sort of Bolshevism into your country, then you have chaos and you'll have a destruction of the system that exists.
Do you assign 10 Days That Shook the World in any of your classes?
I never have, actually. And the reason is I've been teaching Russian history for 20 years at College of DuPage. And the reason is I don't is that I think that it's very difficult for students to read and understand in the historical sense what's going on, because there are lots of names, lots of dates, lots of locations, and lots of acronyms, because the Soviets were in love with acronyms for everything. But I think, though, that it's something that is absolutely a valuable resource to give you a glimpse at that moment. Because the question of the Soviet Union in my lifetime in the 20th century, growing up, was always always cast in stone. So when I was in high school and college in the 1980s, there was no debate.
It's just, and where this was this?
I finished high school in Nebraska.
Nebraska, okay.
And part of what got me interested in Russian studies was the fact that all of my classmates would sit and tell me that this is the evil empire. This is the time of Reagan. And I can remember very distinctly as a sophomore in high school, listening to the wisdom of my 16-year-old classmates tell me that we needed to preemptively nuke all Russians because they were evil people. And I thought that can't really be true. And so I think what we see now in the past 25 years since the collapse of the Soviet Union is a kind of unraveling of that mythology. So why are we so hardened against this country? What's the point? And why are they so hardened against us? And I think what we already have found and will continue to find is that there's a great deal of diverse voices from both the Soviet side, Russian side, and the American side that the Cold War wasn't necessarily as cold as we thought it was.
So do you think that Reed provides an insight at a particularly fluid moment in the relationship between these two nations?
I think the key thing that Reed provides for the readers of 1919 when they read his book and still today, he provides a positive, detailed, credible firsthand account by an accessible American, somebody who writes well, somebody who can explain things. And the question I ask my students when I introduce it to them is what would make an American, Harvard educated, from Oregon, not necessarily very ideological, what would make him observe these events and become such a true believer? And that's true of other people at the time, too, other Americans who witnessed it. What makes it so attractive? Why is this revolution so attractive to these people who have no stake in it? I mean, there's no reason for him to care. He can go home and do something else. And so I think that that's one of the things that I use his work and others to sort of stress to my students is what makes these Americans, you know, jump in so far.
We don't want to try to pretend the Soviet Union was heaven on earth. It was a poor country. And you also ask the question, at what cost? When you go from a country that's 75% peasant in 1917 and become an urban industrial country within 20 years, a process that took 150 years in Germany, in France, in Britain, in the United States, and you compress that into 20 years, when you have that kind of social reorganization of society, there's going to be a lot of social tension, a lot of pressures on families and on individuals. And so it was, in some ways, as a consequence of its dynamism, also a fairly brutal process. You know, when Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels wrote the Communist Manifesto, they did not think the revolution, the socialist revolution, would happen in poor, underdeveloped countries, nor did Lenin. Lenin always thought it would happen in Germany or France. He never expected the Russian Revolution to become the vanguard of the worldwide socialist revolution. Lenin and the Bolsheviks were mainly fighting to end the monarchy in 1905 or 1910 or 1915. It was a consequence of World War I. As Lenin explained, the revolution happened not where the social conditions for socialism were really ripe, but where imperialism was weak. In other words, he said, this really wasn't, we weren't ready for socialism. He said, but we were the weakest link in the imperialist chain. It broke there. The revolution broke it because of the war. And so Russia had its revolution. When Lenin and Trotsky and Stalin, all of the leaders, looked out and saw the world in 1917 after they made the revolution, they said, well, we can win, but only if Germany has a socialist revolution so that we come to our aid. And Lenin said, as soon as the advanced capitalist countries have their revolution, we won't be the vanguard. We'll be like looking to them. We'll be looking to them for assistance culturally, economically. But the other revolutions didn't come. Well, there was a revolution in Germany and in Hungary. It all happened in 1918, but the capitalists overcame it. They didn't have a Bolshevik type party capable of taking advantage of the revolution and seizing and holding power. So the Soviet Union became isolated, so isolated, the most sanctioned, embargoed, blockaded country in the world. We know about the blockade in Cuba. Well, the Soviet Union was completely blockaded. So this poor, illiterate country that had a war and then a civil war and famine had come back by 1920, nobody would trade with it. The worldwide capitalist power said, we're going to destroy it. We're going to snuff it out. We're going to strangle it. And as a consequence, the Soviet Union had to develop on a basis of complete self-reliance on its own indigenous industry rather than having the benefits of worldwide trade.
Mm-hmm. after the fall of the Soviet Union, it was declared the end of history, right? I mean, socialism was tried and failed. Capitalism would rule to the end of time. As a socialist, what's your response?
Well, it's a very important question, because the hubris and arrogance of the apologists of imperialism and capitalism was so at such a high point in 1991 and 92, where they thought, well, or told the world, well, you see, socialism was tried. They conflated socialism with a government, the Soviet Union. It was tried in the Soviet Union, and that government failed. That means socialism failed. And thus, history has stopped, because we went from early primitive society, as they would call it, to feudal society, to capitalist society. But this is it. Now we can live under the rule of billionaires. Our crowning achievement as a species, we've made it. Billionaires will rule. History has shown that the other way isn't going to happen. Is that how people will remember the Soviet Union? I don't think so. The Soviet Union will be looked at in history, not as the end of communism, but as its first valiant experiment. That the flaws and defects that exist in the Soviet Union, and yes, there were many, were not the cause of a planned socialist economy or public property. They were caused by a torturous history, an environment domestically poor, underdeveloped, illiterate society, ravaged by civil war, invaded by 14 imperialist armies, embargoed and deprived technology, invaded by the Nazis and taking 27 million lives and destroying the economy. That was the conditions under which this socialist experiment was conducted. It will be remembered as the first time the red flag was waved, where the working class, the poor, the oppressed, the people who were written off by all previous ruling classes, they said, we could remold society. They made a huge historic achievement to the 20th century, and it will be, because we will learn its lessons, the place, the petri dish where communists and socialists will learn from, not reject. In other words, the Soviet experiment must be embraced and respected as a huge monumental achievement in spite of its defects and flaws.
From a young age, we're taught fidelity to the system and to the state. We all grow up saying the Pledge of Allegiance in school. But the words under God, we take for granted.
Those words were added to the Pledge of Allegiance in 1954 to exclude American communists. Communists, of course, are godless heathens.
That piece of history is largely unknown, but the ideology behind it is probably the most known idea in American society.
This town may appear to be an accurate likeness of a typical American community, but it's a fraud. It isn't free.
Socialism has spread the shadow of human regimentation over most of the nations of the earth. And the shadow is encroaching upon our own liberty.
If a person defends the activities of communist nations while consistently attacking the domestic and foreign policy of the United States, she may be a communist.
Now that you've become acquainted with the enlightened communist system, in contrast to the outdated capitalistic way of life, you are now prepared for the next step of your indoctrination.
You won't have to worry about next year. The state will do your planning from now on.
We'll overthrow it by force and violence. We'll have our way if it means bloodshed and terror.
Because the news about communism is getting around. And it's only another word for slavery.
In almost every industrialized country in the world, socialist parties have huge representations, large membership bodies, and hold many elected seats in government. But in America, everyone knows that being called a socialist or a communist carries an immediate negative connotation. The term is frequently used to smear people and groups, not necessarily for being one, but merely for associating with one.
In the late 1800s, there was an intense battle between organized labor and the country's industrial capitalists. With socialists in the leadership, the labor movement was on the cusp of winning the 8-hour workday, and the corporate owners were willing to do anything to keep working their workers to the bone. Workers on strike all over were shot and killed by police during this fight for what seems like such a basic human right today. In 1887, seven anti-capitalist leaders in the movement were sentenced to death on trumped-up charges, four of them publicly hanged. It was a clear message to anyone involved in radical politics. The battling ideologies of capitalism and socialism in America is more than just opposing arguments. It's been a real battle with real weapons, where one side was exiled, sent to prison, and murdered. Anti-communist paranoia continued to build. Struggles that outraged the rich, like child labor laws and women's right to vote, were labeled red plots. President Woodrow Wilson was helping push for new laws that officially criminalized opinions, not deeds. In 1915, in his State of the Union address, he declared, "There are citizens of the United States who have poured the poison of disloyalty in the very arteries of our national life, who have sought to bring the authority and good name of our government into contempt. Such creatures of passion, disloyalty, and anarchy must be crushed out." And the mission to crush out anti-capitalist ideas was in full effect as World War I began. A coalition of socialists and anarchists who had been leading the militant labor and anti-war struggle was a primary target. Over 90 IWW leaders were mass arrested and given lengthy prison sentences. Repression in the courts was reinforced by hired gangs and lynch mobs allowed by the state to carry out vigilante actions. In 1917, the oil company-controlled newspaper Tulsa World printed on its front page, "The first step in whipping Germany is to strangle the IWWs. Kill them. Just as you would kill any other kind of snake." And they did kill them. In that year alone, big business's thugs, like the Pinkerton Gang, lynched many IWW leaders. Frank Little, a popular IWW leader of mine workers in Butte, Montana, was beaten, dragged behind a car, and hanged from a railroad trestle. That same year, Wilson legislated the criminalization of dissent by passing the Espionage Act. Included in the U.S. government's sweeping definition of espionage, suggesting that you shouldn't be used as cannon fodder in a war between ruling elites. In 1918, famous American socialist and presidential candidate Eugene Debs gave a speech in Canton, Ohio. He said, "Wars throughout history have been waged for conquest and plunder. The feudal barons of the Middle Ages, the economic predecessors of the capitalists of our day, declared all wars, and their miserable serfs fought all battles. Taught to revere their masters, to believe that when their masters declared war upon one another, it was their patriotic duty to fall upon one another, and to cut one another's throats for the profit and glory of the lords and barons. They alone declare war, yours not to reason why, yours but to do and die. If war is right, let it be declared by the people. You, who have your lives to lose, you certainly, above all others, have the right to decide the momentous issue of war or peace." For these words alone, Debs was arrested, convicted, and sentenced to 10 years in prison. The charge? Obstructing recruitment. Many others who did nothing but speak against the war met the same fate. During the patriotic hysteria, the Espionage Act was expanded into the most repressive law in U.S. history. The Sedition Act read, "Whoever shall willfully utter, print, write, or publish any disloyal, profane, scurrilous, or abusive language about the form of government of the United States, or the military or naval forces of the United States, or advocate, teach, defend, or suggest the doing of any of the acts, shall be punished." Over 1,500 people were arrested under this law. Those convicted faced up to 20 years in prison. Everything and everyone was a target. Books and feature films were seized by the government. Every postmaster in the country was under orders to monitor all mail and refuse to mail newspapers and magazines deemed unloyal. For those who were open communists, well, they were just arrested. Under the Smith Act, it was deemed illegal for anyone to be a member of the Communist Party. And in a surprise attack, the state arrested everyone who held a leadership position in the party. All of them were sent to prison. Over 100 were convicted of being communists and given sentences of up to 6 years, jailed for nothing but their beliefs. During this period, 5,000 communists were forced to flee the country. More than 1,000 went to prison. The climate was such that anyone who even leaned to the left was completely persecuted. But just to show how far it would take things in the legal system, the U.S. government went beyond hard prison sentences. In 1951, Communist Party members Julius and Ethel Rosenberg were found guilty of being spies. But their sentences would be much different than their predecessors. The judge convicted them not for espionage, but for the murder of all the American soldiers who had been sent to die in Korea. On June 19, 1953, they were executed.
It seems like there had been waves of anti-communism before World War II, and after World War II, it seemed like anti-communism was pretty much locked in. How did the Cold War impact the repression on the left here at home?
After World War II, you had Soviet Union got stronger, China had its revolution, Vietnam had a revolution, revolutions were happening all over the world against colonialism, so the U.S. elites, bankers, politicians, and of course the repressive agency said, we're going to stop that in its track in the United States, we're not going to let it flower. Communism after World War II became synonymous with the struggle against the Soviet Union. Communism was treated no longer as an indigenous movement for social progress and social justice and equality, but a fifth column, an extension of an enemy state. And of course, the U.S. and the Soviet Union had nuclear weapons pointed at each other. So if you were a communist, if you were sympathetic to the Soviet Union, sympathetic to socialism, then you were a traitor and you were treated as such. And that's what happened. Tens of thousands of people lost their jobs. Hundreds of thousands of people were driven out of industry. People decided then and there, I won't sign a petition, I won't go to a demonstration, I won't have anything to do with the left, because if I do, I could ruin my chances for employment or education, and it could impact my entire family. That's what actually happened in the United States. The United States government has a lot of power. The U.S. media, the corporate-owned media, has represented the view of the United States to the letter. And so the witch hunt that began in 1945, 46, 47, McCarthyism, became what I would say the unofficial religion of the United States. It was an article of faith. You had to swear that you renounced the devil, renounced communism, renounced socialism, so that you could work, so that you could have a career, so that you could thrive in any possible way. It became a rule for existence in the United States. And so you had not only censorship, but self-censorship. Millions of people decided, I'm just not going to identify as a socialist or a communist, even if I think those thoughts, because I can't survive within this system.
Our ad system respects your privacy, but if you'd like to get rid of them entirely, we would love to have you as a member of the show.
To hear it from the right-wing media, a new red menace is upon us.
My gosh, socialism has never failed so vividly as it has in the modern times, and yet these guys come out there and say, that's what America needs. I don't think so.
Venezuela is currently one of the most dangerous places on earth. Hunger and crime are rampant. Clean water and medicine, scarce. So why on earth would anybody want to bring those catastrophic policies and conditions to the U.S.?
The New York Times hailing in a new op-ed, quote, the millennial socialists are coming.
After Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's primary victory earlier this month in New York, the media and the political establishment are reckoning with the specter of a particular brand of left-wing politics.
Democratic socialism, to me, is the basic belief that in a moral and wealthy America, in a moral and modern America, no person should be too poor to live in this country.
In March, the Washington Post ran an op-ed by its staff columnist and avowed socialist Elizabeth Brunig called It's Time to Give Socialism a Try. This week in the Miami Herald, the op-ed headline, they called themselves socialists, but they don't know the meaning of the word. And on ABC's The View, this exchange.
This is what I need from her. Name one country that socialism has ever worked, and also every Democratic socialist who is going on TV Denmark, saying that it's good, needs Norway, to start paying Finland, 90% in taxes.
Iceland.
On your tax form. No, on your tax form.
Socialism, an idea once relegated to the kind of far-left newspapers given out at campus conferences, has become fodder for daytime talk shows, a clear offering in the marketplace of ideas, though its adherents might prefer to think of it as simply an idea whose time has come. Nathan Robinson is editor-in-chief at Current Affairs magazine and a self-described socialist. Nathan, welcome to the show.
Hi, nice to be with you.
This is a word watch to define socialism, which is kind of like having a word watch to define meat.
It's
There's
true.
A lot of different kinds of meat.
So it's not just to like describing meat. It's like describing a lot of abstract terms like love, democracy, liberalism. Broadly, socialism describes a left economic tendency. There are things that nearly all socialists agree on: a skepticism of the concentration of economic power in a few hands, a belief that working people, laborers, need more control over their workplaces, need more ownership over their lives, a broad skepticism of capitalists and landlords. But then what you're going to do about that, there are huge raging arguments among socialists and have been for centuries.
It's fair to say, I suppose, that the common thread is taking care of the many, even at some risk of arguable unfairness to the few.
Yes, and a belief that fairness itself requires justice to all, and there's an egalitarian instinct to it, you know, the fair distribution of resources.
Part of that definition would include status quo, public policy, like Medicare. What parts of the status quo do reflect that kind of socialist worldview?
Well, the parts that guarantee people a basic standard of living and are accessible to all. I just read an article about public libraries and why socialists love public libraries. They are places that are free for everybody. They're controlled by the local people who have authority over them. They're not controlled by a company. And there's that sense of everyone is equal in a public library.
Although it does, to some, seem fearsome. It's the kind of socialism that is usually prefixed with the word creeping.
Well, public libraries embody an egalitarian spirit, and they do sort of challenge the perspective that almost everything other than basic services like police and the military should be left to the market. And public libraries show an example of a well-run state institution. They kind of prove something which is a little dangerous to a certain kind of a free market orthodoxy, which is that they suggest that state-run institutions aren't necessarily a nightmare. So the public library kind of provides a vision of a way that common ownership and common control could work. So I don't think they're necessarily wrong to view it as creeping. I think it does creep.
It's actually not the answer I was expecting.
Oh, sorry.
What I thought you were going to say was, look, yes, but no, because libraries are not collectivism. But this gets to the very point. I guess the fact that there is a relationship is precisely the thing that scares so many people, such as during the Red Scare. Although Soviet communism really isn't the thing that is the big talking point nowadays on the right, it seems to be Venezuela.
You know, as we look at other countries like Venezuela, et cetera, where socialism is imploding their country, do we really want that here?
What happened in Venezuela? They call that democratic socialism, but they don't have toilet paper.
Note to socialism fans, go visit Venezuela.
The fact that a country calls itself socialist, it doesn't really tell you anything. North Korea calls itself a democracy. You have to look at how the country actually operates. For those of us who are democratic socialists, who are very strongly anti-authoritarian, who are skeptical of the concentration of unaccountable power, Venezuela doesn't tell you much at all, because we oppose every measure that would increase centralized and dictatorial power. This isn't a verdict on whether people should have democratic control over their workplaces. They don't have that in Venezuela, just like they didn't have it in the USSR. And that's why there were a lot of libertarian socialists, people like Bertrand Russell and Emma Goldman and Alexander Berkman, were all horrified by the Soviet Union. Emma Goldman wrote an essay, There Is No Communism in Russia. Her whole idea was, well, it only exists if people are actually equal. And equality was a lie in the Soviet Union. So it doesn't invalidate the idea of equality. What it invalidates is using authoritarian methods to sort of impose the illusion of equality on people by force.
A moment ago, we played a clip from Fox and Friends to show their horror at the word socialism. But you don't have to go to the propaganda mouthpiece of the Trump White House to get that reaction. Here's a clip from CBS in which Nancy Pelosi was asked to respond to Republicans who say that Democratic socialists are ascendant in her party.
No, they're not. It's ascendant in that district, perhaps, but I don't accept any characterization of our party presented by the Republicans.
The Democrats are terrified of the word, too. Why?
Well, I think some of them sincerely believe that from a pragmatic perspective, they have to distance themselves from that word because, you know, especially for older Democrats, they remember the Cold War. They think that America has been trained for a century to be horrified by this concept. But I think they don't understand. People in my generation have had to witness an economy that has crushed so many of our peers in debt and in hopelessness. We want a different word, and we want something that can help to distinguish the values that we're putting forward from the values that have built the economy that we see treating people so badly.
In February of last year, during a CNN town hall that was happening, that was hosted by Jake Tapper, House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi, she kind of chastised an NYU sophomore, Trevor Hill, who pointed out that maybe what the Democrats needed was a more stark contrast to right-wing economics to attract younger voters, as the Tea Party had. And then just a couple of weeks ago, again on CNN, 33-year-old former South Carolina state lawmaker Bakari Sellers, a CNN commentator, said, "I don't care if I get in trouble for saying this. I've been saying it since I'm blue in the face. Our Democratic leadership is old and stale." How much do you think there is a generational divide within the Democratic Party when it comes to considering what might be described as a more socialist prescription for the economy?
I think it's a really vast generational divide. I think that polling bears it out, but you can see it really well in how the kids lined up in the 2016 primaries, with Sanders being pretty openly about sort of social democratic programs and a social democratic approach to governance. And then, you know, you had the sort of remainder, the older segments of the party lining up behind more traditional democratic candidate in Clinton. And I think that, you know, more and more you see that, you know, even kids younger than millennials tend to be leaning a little bit more radical, probably as a result of having grown up in the aftermath of the Great Recession.
You write that my answer is admittedly more ambitious. It's time to give socialism a try. In your opinion, to what extent is being more socialist still electoral political suicide?
Well, I mean, it didn't, Sanders did remarkably well being not really contesting the label of socialism. I mean, one of the things about being called a socialist at this point is for the last 8 years, Republicans called Obama a socialist over nothing, over pretty ordinary traditional democratic policies that were maybe a nudge less ambitious than most New Deal programs. So the label has really lost a lot of its bite, I think, at this point. And also we have, you know, countries in the Nordic countries that are doing, you know, pretty well with policies that are rightfully described as socialist. I think it's probably still pretty suicidal, but maybe not as suicidal as it once was, more self-harm.
So to what degree, then, do you think that the right unintentionally watered down the meaning of socialism?
Yeah, I mean, I think they certainly had a hand in it. The whole generation of kids has grown up, over essentially a decade watching the right say, kind of lightly modifying insurance markets to get people on health care. That's socialism. And the right described all kinds of things Obama did as socialism. They accused Michelle Obama of being some kind of socialist for trying to make school lunches healthier. And so I think there is certainly an effect of, as to where socialism for the Cold War generation is the worst possible, most totalitarian thing you can imagine. For kids who are growing up now, socialism is what? It's Obama, it's Bernie Sanders, it's Sweden. That doesn't sound so bad.
Right. And you quote the late, great scholar Mark Fisher writing, it's easier to imagine the end of the world than the end of capitalism. What would you say to someone, because you were touching on the Soviet Union, what would you say to someone who argues that pursuing socialism is a dead end and it's proven to be a dead end because, look, the Soviets failed and capitalism won?
Yeah, well, there are a lot of ways to create a failed state. Certainly, it's the case that you can have a failed socialist state and you can have socialist policies that conclude in travesty. The same is true of capitalism. I'm not proposing totalitarianism, and I also think that if you look at plenty of other countries, and the right is schizophrenic on this, about half the time the right says that Sweden, Denmark, Norway, Finland, etc., they're not socialist. They're just capitalist with redistribution policies. And then about the other half of the time, they do say they're socialist, and that's usually when people are proposing we do what they're doing. So they're not really decided on whether or not they're socialist. I think they're pretty socialist. I think you have to look at policies on a spectrum. But they're also doing pretty well, and they have all kinds of good indicators. They rank well in terms of happiness. Internationally, they're happier than Americans, and they all have good health indicators, education indicators. So, I mean, I think there are ways to do socialism that appear to be working.
To what degree do you think American capitalism is failing because Soviet communism failed? That is, capitalism is failing because it is now seen as supreme, and anything even remotely socialist within the U.S. social safety net and reining in big business with regulations is undone.
Yeah, I mean, certainly the politics of the Cold War have had lasting consequences in how America handles its own economic system, its own political economy. I think that capitalism has its own problems. That are just inherent to it and that have been around for as long as capitalism has been around and have been noted for just as long. I think that the American unwillingness to even try to kind of temper some of the effects of capitalism for its own good, to stabilize it and secure it, maybe have made American capitalism more volatile than capitalism in countries where they're more willing to go in with stronger regulation to kind of stabilize it. In that sense, I can see how the impact of the Cold War has made American capitalism even more difficult to sustain.
People don't agree on this subject. They don't agree on how to define capitalism. They don't agree on how to define socialism. And of course, then they cannot agree on what the difference is between the two of them, since they don't agree on what it is. So maybe the best way to handle this is to tell you briefly what has been in the past the dominant understanding, because that will then allow me to tell you how and why it's changing now. And that's simply the reality people have to get used to if they're going to enter into this debate. Okay, so traditionally, emerging out of the 19th century and dominant for the 20th century, here was the basic idea. Capitalism, it was said, is a system in which the means of production, factories, buildings, money, cash, all of that, was privately owned by individuals, either as individual persons or in groups, whereas socialism was publicly owned. That is, the society as a whole would collectively own the means of production, and they would be managed by the representative of the whole people, namely the government or the state. So capitalism is private ownership of means of production. Socialism is collective or state ownership. And the second basic difference was that in a capitalist system, goods and services go from the producer, those who make them, to the consumer, those who use them, by means of a market exchange. That is, the producer sells what has been produced to the consumer who buys it. To be very literal, it means that the produced object, whether it's a good or a service, has to go through an exchange process before it reaches the consumer. By contrast, socialism was defined as an arrangement in which the passage from production to consumption was done by a collectively organized plan. Planning was socialism, market exchange was capitalism. So to make it very simple, capitalism is private ownership and markets, and socialism is collective or state ownership and government planning that could be organized in a variety of ways. That's why, for example, in the Soviet Revolution or in the Chinese Revolution, when the change was organized, private property was withdrawn from private owners and given over to the state in the name of the whole people, and markets were either suppressed or made secondary to a general plan, which it was the government's responsibility to organize. Capitalism was overcome by socialism, the argument went, when the state took over private ownership and state planning took dominance over markets if they were left at all to play a role. The problem with this definition was always the same. Namely, nothing was changed in the immediate production relationship. In other words, the relationship between who gives you the order of what to do in the workplace, where to sit, what machine to use, in what way, for what period of time, in what relationship to others working, all of the questions of the organization of the workplace were not touched in this discussion. It was as if it didn't matter. It was as if you had made the revolution simply by changing the ownership and the distribution system, not by the relationships. What has happened now is, for a number of reasons, that old definition of the difference has been rejected. Not by everybody. This is an ongoing process. But the new direction, which I am part of and which I believe is becoming dominant, is critical of the old definition, basically around the idea that to change the ownership and to change the system of distribution simply is not enough. That when you do that, but you leave in place the organization of the actual work process and the work relationships and the work structure, you are leaving in place a crucial part of capitalism. So now let me explain this argument. In this view, what distinguishes capitalism from other systems isn't private ownership and isn't market distributions. This perspective reminds us that in the old feudal system and in the prior slavery systems, you also had markets. You also had private ownership of slaves, private ownership at various times of land in feudalism, and so on. So that the proper way, the new way, the more emerging way, is to say that the distinction between capitalism and other systems should be focused on the relationships in work, in the process of producing the goods and services without which we cannot live. So that, for example, slavery, the relationship is one group of people owns another group of people. In feudalism, one group of people, the lords, have complete dominion, domination, over another group of people called serfs. In capitalism, you don't have the slavery relationship and you don't have the feudal relationship. You have the relationship of employer to employee. One group of people gives the opportunity to work and the other group of people depends on having the opportunity of work given to them in an exchange of wages for labor. Okay, with this framework, what is then the distinction between capitalism and socialism? And then the answer becomes very clear and precise. Socialism is when you overcome, you end the relationship of employer to employee. No longer do you divide some people in the production process who are the board of directors, the corporate leaders, the ones who decide what to produce, how to produce, where to produce, and what to do with the profits, and other people whose job it is to come 5 or 6 days a week, do what they are told, and then go home. That's over. Socialism, in this perspective, is when the workers together as a society or a community, socialism, communism, that's when workers democratically together, one worker, one vote, decide all the basic decisions of the production world. Then you have socialism. And until then, you don't have socialism, which means you have to come up with another phrase to capture the Soviet Union or the People's Republic of China. And for lack of time, the answer is these are state forms of capitalism. Why? Because the state owns and the state plans. But we call it capitalism because the state has not, or at least not yet, removed the employer-employee relationship.
Socialism is not just somebody has a good idea. Oh, let's have a socialist system. Any more than capitalism was just a good idea. Oh, feudalism. Yeah, kings and aristocracy and lords. You know what? I got an idea for a whole new system. Let's have capitalism. It doesn't begin as an idea. It begins as an objective process of how human society develops. And how human the economies of human society develop. And, you know, we learn how to make tools, and now we don't want to have, you know, our tribal society that was built on just gathering berries and, you know, running around chasing animals. All of a sudden we had agriculture and animal husbandry.
Yeah.
And our society changes. And with that, the ideas change. So we start to become conscious of what's possible. Because of objective developments, it's not all just springing from people's heads. So to apply that idea to Venezuela, I mean, Hugo Chavez comes to power because neoliberalism and one of the first big mass protests against this hyper-capitalist policies was in Venezuela prior to Chavez getting elected and prior to his involvement in an attempted coup. But these policies were destroying Venezuela. And people, you know, they rose up against these policies. The hypercapitalism wasn't working. And the exploitation of the oil resources was, you know, tiny elite was benefiting from it. And people were conscious of this. So sure, socializing the benefits of that oil, it was obvious as a way out of the situation. You have a movement and you have leaders that emerge from the movement. And it is what it is, meaning, you know, it wasn't, they didn't have some great worked out plan. It wasn't, you know, a party with a head, you know, economists and all kinds of people to figure out what to do once you get elected. You know, stuff happens. They may have been as surprised as anyone that they actually wound up running the country.
Sure.
And with all its defects and all its weaknesses and all its warts, the Venezuelan or Bolivarian Revolution, it accomplished a lot. And it wasn't just about spreading more of the oil money around. There was, and I guess still is, I haven't been for a while, and I don't have the same kind of handle on it, but the kind of community decision-making, community governance at the local levels, there were real experiments and developing different forms of democracy, which has to be part of the socialistic conversation. Because, like, you have a big state-owned sector in China,
right?
But you don't have any democracy to speak of, and you have a class of billionaires that have emerged that run the Communist Party. So I don't know what kind of socialism it is. It's not socialism just because you have state ownership.
Right.
And on the other hand, there's a certain amount of planning going on in China. People's standard of living is going up. They're complicated processes, and we need to analyze them as such. But I'll go back to where I was in the beginning.
The reason we need to have this conversation of what does a modern socialist system look like and how will it operate and what are the features of it? You know, we talk about, you know, even the United States is a mixed economy. There's socialistic features. We got a publicly owned post office.
Sure.
We got publicly
public
owned libraries and schools and such. Why? Because it made so much sense. Mm-hmm. But the same sense that it made to do that has made sense to have socialized healthcare in virtually every advanced capitalist country. It makes sense here. But once that makes sense, so does banking. Like, why would you have let big banks blackmail a whole society and a whole economy so that they can go speculate?
Sure.
I guess I just want to end on where I started. It's not just some intellectual conversation. Is socialism good or bad? Yeah, there's been, as frankly, any major transformation of human society, there's going to be tremendous fault and weaknesses and you know, stupidities, especially, you know, if you talk about the Soviet Union trying to build socialism in what was a very backward country. And that was a matter of great debate at the time. But we need to look at this. We need to talk about it because capitalism is failed. It's failed most of the population of this world for the, you know, at least the last 100 years. But most importantly, it has no solutions to the actual threat to us as human society. Like, capitalism's completely out of steam with the most urgent threats facing us. So it's not just some idea to let, cafe conversation. This is about our existence or not. And unless somebody has some other idea, and I don't think there is, when you look at what there is, you need to you've got to break up the concentration of ownership, because with concentration of ownership goes concentrated political power. Everybody understands that. But there's no way to wait against that without public ownership. Like, how else do you break up concentrated ownership? It's not because you're going to give everybody a share of a company. That's not going to happen. The only counterweight to concentrated private ownership is public ownership. On the other hand, public ownership in a small number of hands, like a single party state or some of the models of the 20th century, that's as dangerous, because concentrated power, even if it's in the name of socialism, will also be a disaster, will be become a dictatorship, because concentrated ownership equals concentrated political power. So we got to look at how does this public ownership look in a way that's very diversified? You know, whether it's ownership at a city level, at a state level, at the federal level when necessary, whether it's workers' co-ops, whether it's regional conglomerations. But I've said this before, we're in an era now because of artificial intelligence where you could coordinate an economy like that. You could have a Green New Deal, which is mostly built out of public ownership in many ways so that it doesn't get too concentrated, and still coordinate that. I don't think it was ever possible in human history to have the kind of socialism that could also be democratic. And as I said before, I don't think there's any choice to this, because the alternative is we're not going to have civilization at all.
So I think a lot of people are aware of socialism now, especially since we have a self-proclaimed democratic socialist running for president, but they don't actually understand what it means. I think they're taking little bits and pieces, free healthcare, free education. Talk about the means of production and how a socialist economy would actually be structured.
They came up with the following idea, that the problem of capitalism is two fundamental things. One, that private individuals own the means of production. They own the land, they own the factories, they own the stores, the machinery, and that the people, the owners, are really a very small part of the population. 1%, 2%, 5%, maybe even 10%, although rarely did it get that high. But that means the vast majority of people are never part of the owners. And the basic socialist idea was, if you allow a small number of people to control the means of producing all the goods and services we all need to survive, they're going to use that control to make the system work for them. And they're not going to worry about the rest of us. In other words, it's a recipe for a society that produces wealth for the top 5 to 10%, but not for everybody else. That gives power, political and other power, to those at the top and not to everybody else. So the socialist idea was, this is fundamentally unjust, fundamentally undemocratic. This is what's wrong with capitalism. And how do you solve it? You make collective ownership, not private. The society as a whole should own the means of production, the factories, the offices, the stores, so that they are good for everybody, so that what they produce is distributed roughly equally, so that the influence and the decisions are made. So social, that's why it's called socialism. It's the society that should own. It focuses on the workplace. Its idea is the way you make sure that the government never again becomes an institution over the people, but rather simply an instrument of the people, is by making sure that at the base of society, where people live and work, the wealth, the productive capability is in their hands. If you want the slogan of 21st century socialism, it's this: democratize the enterprise. End this process where there's a handful of people who make the decision. In most American corporations, and corporations do the bulk of the business in modern capitalism, a tiny group of what are called major shareholders, the people who have big blocks of shares, they select who the board of directors. 1% of Americans own 3/4 of the shares. It's highly concentrated. A tiny number of people, the 1%, own the bulk of the shares. How do you run a corporation? At the top is something called a board of directors, usually 15 to 20 people. How do you get on the board of directors? There's an election every year to get on that board. And the way the election works is, if you own a share of stock in the company, you get one vote. If you have 10 shares, you get 10 votes. If you own 1 million shares, you get 1 million votes. If you have no shares, that's how many votes you get. So there's no pretense of democracy. So if a handful of people own the bulk of the shares, they control everything. They select the 15 or 20 people on the board of directors. The board of directors decides what the company produces, how the company does it, where the company is located, and what's done with the profits. Everybody helps produce the profits. The employees have to live with the decision, but have no influence on it. It is the opposite of democracy. And if you don't have democracy at the workplace, you can't ever have it real in politics either, because those at the top will buy the political system, something which we see in the United States so starkly every day that everyone knows. If workers took over a factory, had a worker co-op instead of a top-down, and the workers together decided what to do with the profits, you think they'd give a few executives $25 million so they have more money than they know what to do with, while everybody else has to borrow money to send their kids to college? It'll never happen. You think a collection of workers, say 400 in a factory, considering that you could make more money if you moved the production to China, are they going to vote to get rid of their own jobs? It's not going to happen. They're not going to destroy their community by having an empty factory. They're not going to deprive their local government of the tax revenues to run the schools and the hospitals. And they're not going to deprive themselves of jobs. So what we've had in the last 40 years, all those jobs leaving, would never have left if it was the collective decision of the workers where this production is going to take place.
Soviet Union collapsed 23 years ago. The pretext for fighting communism as part of an international fight against an enemy state, that's gone. That's vanished. Capitalism can no longer compare itself to the Soviet Union. It can only compare itself to itself. And we see within the capitalist society a growing hardship, growing
income inequality, growing poverty. One out of every two Americans lives in or near poverty. And so as a consequence of this economic division and the inability to justify the old anti-communism, there's new space opening up for socialism. And you see the Occupy movement. People said, we are the 99%. That was kind of the harbinger of the beginning of a new socialist context. The Sanders campaign, even though I don't agree with Bernie Sanders on many issues, the fact that tens of thousands of people come to someone who says he's a self-proclaimed socialist and says there should be an end to income inequality, that there should be greater equality, the fact that he's on the front cover of Time magazine and it says socialize this, America, and that's not a bad thing, that means we're seeing a new day. The fog of anti-communism, the bigotry, the prejudice, that's starting to lift. And the Sanders campaign's success, surprising success, or the Occupy movement's sudden, spontaneous growth nationwide, these are harbingers of what's coming.
This war on ideas and alternatives is still being relentlessly pursued every day. Even 50 years after the Cold War, the empire continues to wage war on every remaining country trying to build up socialism, refusing to let even one nation develop alternatives without the constant threat of subversion and overthrow. Because the last thing the system wants is an example that undermines its supreme truth. The inability to question this dogma is deeply ingrained. After all, capitalism is the bedrock of America. But like every other myth that acts as the glue to our society, this too needs to be challenged. The planet is in deep crisis, where war and inequality define our world. Unfettered capitalism and endless consumption cannot and will not last. The elite at the helm won't ever give up their security for the good of humanity. And the old guard will use every weapon in its arsenal to maintain domination. The Empire's long war against any alternative that challenges this crushing reality is unconscionable. We have the right to criticize the system itself without being labeled shut down or worse. We can't let the rulers of this system dictate the boundaries of our discussion. Because in this era, where alternatives are desperately needed, we have to unite to marginalize their ideas. Not let them marginalize ours.
Thanks for listening to another throwback episode plucked from the archives to give you context for today. For more like this, check the feed, as this is a weekly feature of the show that's in addition to all of our new episodes. As always, keep the comments coming in. You can leave a voicemail or text at 202-999-3991 or email me to j@bestofleft.com. These episodes are remastered and produced by Dion Clark, Aaron Clayton, and myself. We also produce funny and informative bonus episodes along with Amanda Hoffman, as thanks to those who support the show by becoming a member or purchasing gift memberships to the show. If you get value out of the show, we'd appreciate your support at bestofleft.com/support, through our Patreon page, or from right inside the Apple Podcasts app. And if you want to continue the discussion, join our Discord community. There's a link to join in the show notes. So, coming to you from far outside the conventional wisdom of Washington, D.C., my name is Jay, and this has been the Best of the Left podcast, with new episodes coming to you twice weekly, thanks entirely to the members and donors to the show from bestofleft.com.